Townsman. Alfonso. Townsman, let's just suppose, for the sake of supposing silly things, that Stanley Kubrick was born in 1962 instead of 28. He's still born in the Bronx, okay? He still takes a principal interest in photography at the right time, and ignoring all the massive differences in cinema that would have so drastically altered his approach to filmmaking, he's still very much the head honcho, a highly regarded and respected director among his peers. There's just one big difference, Townsman. Can you guess what it is?
That his movies haven't influenced a bunch of people because they are not out yet? I don't know
nice
what.
Nice try, Townsman, but no. He makes Doom maps. Stanley Kubrick, born 1962, makes Doom maps. Unfortunately, some other bastard visionary nipped his idea for the pioneering science fiction epic in the bud right before it could get around to production. So, he had to turn to Doom. To make the big one. In 2002. To realize his drama. Of course, by this time, he was mad, living out of skips and stuff, but that's beside the point. The Space Odyssey was a complete success and gained Kubrick the much-needed respect of all his peers and fans in the Doom community. What a wonderful story, Thompson.
What is a wonderful story?
It's a shame we won't be talking about it today.
Oh,
we're
no,
talking
no.
About something else.
Yeah, we're talking about the real 2002.
The real 2002 A Doom Odyssey. And in this episode of Where's All the Data, the first in this series, we take aim at the map set. A 38-strong map replacement for the Ultimate Doom, helmed by Paul Corfiadis, and featuring level designers such as Christian Arrow, Chris Hansen, and Virgil the Doom Poet. Townsman, start with the gameplay.
The gameplay of 2002 A Doom Odyssey can best be described as sterile. For the most part, bland would be another word I would use, and it's very, let's say, too clean, but it's done in a way that it doesn't ever really throw any curveballs at you, and you got a lot of maps that when they try and change things up, you don't do enough with their concept. Map 4 of episode 2 is based around shotgunners. Okay, I can accept that as a concept, but here's really where it drives home the sterileness of 2002 A Doom Odyssey's gameplay. That map introduces the concept of a shotgunner teleporting behind you. It then takes that concept and plows it into the ground. It just keeps on digging, hits rock bottom, and keeps on trying. And that's really the biggest failing of 2002 A Doom Odyssey. Even when it goes for concept-based gameplay, it doesn't exploit the concept. And so you end up with a lot of levels that play the same from start to finish, and then when you eventually do get a concept map, it still plays the same from start to finish. So the entire map set basically feels like it's playing the same the whole way through, mm-hmm. which makes it kind of mind-numbing in places.
Mm-hmm. In fact, of course, I was the one who actually played for it at first on the stream through, which you can check out on my Twitch TV account, which I can't link it, but I'll say it at the end of this podcast. But yes, you would expect, me having actually played through the map set, that I would be able to remember many things. And it's true, certainly, of episodes 3 and 4, which were superior, I think, to the first two episodes, which I can't really remember anything about at all. Save for some of the really, really wacky music selections which sort of serve to remind me, such as E2M1 of certain maps. But yeah, it really does all melt together in my mind. And there's a number of reasons for this, I think, on the gameplay side of things. It's incredible. I mean, you use the word sterile. I think that's a good word to use. I wouldn't dress it up that much. I would just say it's boring. I mean, sterile is a good word, but boring, absolutely boring. Dull. And that's the heaviest criticism. And why is this the case? Well, unfortunately, it's due to more than just Paul's design. I think it's even all of the other authors, such as Christian Arrow, who we usually regard, or at least I've heard you regard him in the past, as sort of someone who does Paul's design better. He falls into the same traps, I think, and just creates that overall sensation of everything's melting together into a forgettable mass of maps.
Absolutely, and I think because Paul and Christian Arrow dominate so heavily at the start, and the mappers who really stand out and do different stuff with their gameplay, such as Chris Hansen, His stuff is all, you know, pushed to the back. Most of it's in E4 with one map in E2 and E3. And those maps are the maps that stand out, mainly because with the Christian Hansen maps, they at least do something different each map. E2, M2 is all about timed doors. And, you know, it exploits that concept, but it keeps doing different things with it versus the shotgunner map later on. And then E3 M6 is all about damaging floors. And I've criticized Rex's E3 M7 in his Infernos campaign for this. And to be a massive hypocrite, I actually liked the lack of provisions in Chris Hansen's E3 M6. Because it did make you constantly push forward, and my criticism, and I think I share this with you, is that there's not a clear path all the time, so that kind of makes that lack of provisions detrimental to the map. But that map had its own thing, and you know, it did still fall into the place similar from start to finish, but it changed sizes and shapes and the execution of areas enough that it didn't feel it fell into the same trap that most of the other maps fell into. And then, you know, you get to his E4 stuff. E4 M3 is really cramped, and for good or for bad, that's, you know, it's different from the other maps.
Those barons, indeed.
And then, you know, E4, M4 is more open with walkways over damaging floors.
And Brown Hug, yes.
And E4, M5 is it's very interconnected. And then E4, M7 is all about platforming, and it's very 3D. Mm-hmm. So each map felt different, and it's really a shame that, you know, that couldn't be applied to the whole map set as a whole, to where the majority of the maps do just kind of blend into this forgettable blob of filler.
Unfortunately, yes. From what I've seen on the thread, the Doomworld Megawad Club thread, on which this stream through and podcast is based, there have been some people that criticize Chris Hansen's design. I can't remember the criticisms precisely. But I think whatever your criticisms are of his design, it's true to say that they're at least interesting. And it's much needed that there's a diversity in the map set that simply isn't present because of the likes of Peekoff and, unfortunately, Christian Arrow, who, now that I think back on it, I can't really pick out many of his maps, save for E1 M6. Perhaps a couple of others might come to me later on. But yeah, it does all melt together. So it's Chris Hansen's presence, whether or not you really like it, is, I think, overall a positive for the map set.
Yeah, and let's move into design, because I don't think we could really talk about why the gameplay fails in 2002 A Doom Odyssey without specifically talking about the design.
And
I think the biggest problem with the design is the constant use of symmetrical layouts within symmetrical layouts. Like, it's not just room symmetry. It's room symmetry and total map symmetry, which means that thing placement then becomes symmetrical.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And, you know, one thing that I am... Could you elaborate on that, actually, just to continue?
So you enter a room, and if the room's entirely symmetrical...
Uh-huh.
You generally have a good idea of how the room's going to play out. And I'm not saying symmetry is a bad thing in Doom. It's absolutely not. I use it all the time. A lot of map designers I respect use it all the time.
As long as it's not exclusively symmetry.
Yes, as long as it's not. So, like, you'll enter a room, and this is particularly a problem in E1. There'll be, like, a set of opening doors that reveal a monster trap. Well, because the room's symmetrical, the monsters that reveal, it's going to be a symmetrical room with symmetrical opening doors, and inside that, it's like each monster cage is going to have like a shotgunner and a demon and an imp and another shotgunner, and then the cage on the other side is going to be an exact duplicate of that. Like, the item placement isn't changed at all. So there's not a lot of thought really put into designing the levels around thing placement. So there's not a lot of like vantage points and, you know, positions for a lot of crossfire.
Right.
It's mostly demons coming at you head on, with a few ambushes just being like total engulfing ambushes in tight areas.
Right.
With you, the outdoor areas not really having a lot of opportunities to really suppress the player and keep you moving around. And this dissipates as it goes on, mainly because Pequorf doesn't dominate the later episodes as much as he and Christian Arrow do E1. I think E1's definitely the biggest defender of bland gameplay. And so that's for thing placement, but then it gets into progression and layout where you have a lot of maps that, like, E1, like, half the maps, the entire back half of E1, and then later on most of Pequorf's maps, like the boss maps and his few maps in E4,
sure,
are hub spokes. And they're not even disguised hub spokes. Well, the secret level for E1 is kind of disguised.
But you saw through it.
But you can easily see through it. Like, and the biggest problem with that is that the most basic form of the hub spoke, and this applies to the other aspects of the gameplay too, they're all the most basic form of the idea, and so without, you know, the little fancy dressing it up, it comes across as extremely bare, regardless of, like, not visually bare, but, you know, gameplay-wise bare, mm-hmm. And so you know what you're doing all the time. Like, if I walk into a hub spoke, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go down this path, I'm going to grab a key, I'm going to come back here, I'm going to go down that path, et cetera, et cetera. And that plays into the room symmetry that you can walk into any area in it and not have to figure it out at all and just know what you're doing. So it becomes mind-numbing to run through the levels because it's like, oh, I know what I'm doing here and I know what I'm doing. And there's a key on the pillar there because we always have to have a key on the pillar.
You know, this particular point brings me to my two major criticisms of Pequorf's design and on the whole, I guess, of 2002 A Demodicy, since we're judging it as in its entirety here. Like an album. And that's with this particular design that you highlight, the hub spokes, the symmetry, and the repetitiveness of that design. You come to anticipate this from Pequorf, and not just like in the next room, in the immediate room, for the entire map and the maps thereafter, you can see what's coming. And when you can anticipate that sort of gameplay, for me at least, I become hugely depressed. If I know what's coming, then I like to be surprised as a player. I like new things to come at me. And I don't mean those new things. You know, if you're going to attempt to do teleporting shotguns, such as in Shotgun Blues or whatever that map was, for example, or that dog ham barrel trap in E1M4, those aren't really sort of gameplay, interesting gameplay points that sort of spice things up in an interesting way. Those are just dick moves. So it's that problem of anticipation and of not expecting anything new and not being delivered anything new unless it's in that sort of ballpark, the barrel traps. That's one of my major points of criticism about Pequorf's design and the maps on the whole. The other one is something I brought up when I was playing through and I stumbled across E1M3. There was nothing in particular wrong with that map. Well, there was. But this point came across it because I'd played three maps up to that point, and I could already see this trend coming. And that was that when I was thinking of counter-criticisms to this map, and people say, you know, Pequorf's design is just go to X, then go to Y, find a key, find that objective to complete, and then the counter-criticism would be, yes, but that's just Doom. That's true. That's true of any map. But a good map will do its best to dress up the basic mechanics and make it more interesting. And that's something that Pequorf doesn't do, I don't think. And I guess also in this map set, Christian Arrow, it's basic in the most mundane possible way. It needs to be dressed up more, and I don't see that. And, sorry, barrel traps and teleporting shotgun guys don't do it for me.
Speaking of that barrel trap, that's a prime example of another gameplay filling. There's actually another barrel trap that's equally ridiculous in Shotgun Blues, where if you shoot the barrels, you avoid it, but you basically walk into a room, if you haven't shot the barrels, you get teleported on top of them and instantly die. And that is my problem with traps like that is I don't mind instant death traps if they're handled in a way like that barrel trap in E1M4. If you're walking along and it introduces you to, like, the concept of barrels coming out of the wall.
Computer
like,
walls.
Whatever the wall's going to be, it's like this wall, barrels can come out of it. And so, like, in a controlled environment where you can see, you can observe it, and you can say, okay, I see that, I understand it, I know that's going to happen. And then, you know, it puts you in a more complex version of that trap to where you can't say, well, I had no idea that was coming, and just be like, what the heck was that? Why did I die? You can be like, okay, that's what killed me. I understand the trap.
Absolutely.
And that's just part of the problems. And then going back to the basicness of how, yes, these maps are Doom in basic form. P-Corf is guilty of it. Christian Aro in this map set is guilty of it. But I think the biggest offender is Rory Havoc. He made E2 M3, which is up there for the worst maps in the set. And if it wasn't for the Kako trap at the end of his E3 map, that'd be up there too. Those are probably the most basic hallway, room, objective, no dressing, just box connected to box connected to box.
And, you know, when I actually got to that kick and even trap, it's not even that great a setup, really. In fact, I mean, it was fun to start with until I realized that I didn't have nearly enough ammunition. In fact, I don't think you can actually defeat that swarm on this.
Right. There are 93 Kako demons in it.
Thanks for counting that. But yeah, even when I got to that, and it's not that interesting an encounter, but I was so desperate for a switch up by that point that I couldn't help but enjoy it as much as I did. Because otherwise it's an inherently flawed encounter. Actually, on that point, when I first reached that map, I was very pleased that I was actually able to move around. There was a slight element of non-linearity to it, or maybe that was just a perceived non-linearity. Certainly it was more open, which is something that wasn't in the map set since E196, and even only that to a point. So that's another criticism I have to say, is that the design, the elements that we've discussed that we dislike, there's more to it than that. It's also the fact that the scale of the map's always roughly the same, both on the micro and the macro scale, which is to say that, you know, the room scale's always the same, but you can always expect the same sort of trends in map sizes. But it doesn't really change it up in that way either, and I was so desperate for some sort of sandbox layout, something which I never really got, but at least E1M6 and that Hasbic map. Similar enough.
They're similar.
Sorry, Rory.
Yeah, until the E4, when things did start getting changed, you had big maps like E4 M6, which was such a welcome addition. I mean, it even came after a bunch of good maps, I didn't really like E4 M3, but it came after two good maps, and then there was that, and I was like, okay, thank you, E4, thank you. It's sad that it was at the end of, you know, that entire slog, but yeah, I think that the scale doesn't change too much, and not every single P-Corf map was bad. E2 M7 was pretty good.
Puzzles to solve, sure.
Yes.
Even though there weren't any puzzles, from what I could tell.
I don't believe there were any puzzles. But, that was just part of the really odd naming scheme that
people has gone. Caves of Bosnia, anyone?
Caves of Bosnia, Lugano Base ZRX. And then, of course, Chris Hansen's adjective thing. Madness.
Did you have an overall favorite episode, considering?
Definitely episode 4.
Uh-huh. Was that down to Chris Hansen's being present? E4M6, I think it was.
Yeah, E4M6.
Which was by,
trying to remember his name. It's Pillai or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. God.
Okay.
Yeah.
He knows who he is, at least.
He knows who he is. And then it also had the only secret map that I really felt secret mappy.
Ah, by Mr. Doom, Virgil the Doom Poet.
And I, the map that he made, I think, is very appropriate given his name being Virgil the Doom Poet. It did not disappoint at all. It was very odd and experimental, and something that if you could take the poem a college student who sits under a tree all day would write and turn it into a map, it'd probably be something like that.
Certainly a standout map then in the set. On gameplay grounds alone, then you wouldn't recommend, I mean, I'm not sure you'd recommend 2002 of Doom Odyssey in any case, but on the grounds of gameplay alone, would you even recommend someone download it to check out any independent maps?
I'd say yeah. Check out Chris Hansen's maps and check out Joe Pelai's maps.
Mm-hmm. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's interesting because I just remembered E3M6, which I think is called Obituary Written, which you brought up a little earlier, and which many people thoroughly dislike because of its lack of rev suits and the fact that you're made to wander across while you're figuring out where you're going. You're depleting all your resources and stuff like that, and so you get to the point where in order to progress the map, you have to go across damaging sectors, and you could put yourself in an unwinnable situation, which I did, incidentally. But you know what? I didn't mind it. I mean, it was totally dick. It did need some more rev suits. But again, it was like this sort of that Cacodium encounter. I so badly needed a switch up, even if it was of that sort, that I didn't mind it ultimately. I'm sure if I went back and played it as its own map, I would like it significantly less. But yeah, again, it just accents that point that there was not enough diversity into it. I think that's my main point, aside from those two major design points I brought up earlier.
Oh, definitely, and yeah, I would say play through E4, even if the final map of E4 is not good at all. In fact, I distinctly recall you being done by that point.
Oh yeah,
but yeah, I'd say E4 alone is worth checking out. It was overall pretty decent, mainly because it was dominated by the people who hadn't mapped up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, clearly gameplay the biggest category, but we can't spend all day reviewing this, but I'm sure we could if we wanted to. So here at Where's All the Data, we don't do numbers for reviews, results. We don't give it a mark out of 10. We go on something slightly outre, outlandish, out there, as you do. Qu'est-ce que le diff? And I want to give gameplay C- with an added F sharp. You can go play that on your harpsichord and tell me how that sounds. Probably quite bad. Anyway, let's move on to the visuals now. Tonsman.
The visuals are the gameplay in visual form, for the most part. there are some, like E4, for the most part, has some pretty nice-looking maps. E4, M6, of course. Even if... I'm in agreement with you that there could have been more areas where the sky was used to create contrast, so the map wasn't so dark overall. Like, a lot of the wandering inside was very dark. But no, Peacorp has a very specific visual design, and Christian Aro has it too. And with E1, I think E1 suffers the most from being E1. It tries to capture E1's style in that it uses, you know, the support 2 for texture transitions and stuff like that. But it uses the textures in the same way it would if it was an E1 map, but doesn't use an architectural style that really benefits that.
Sure.
So I think that that's really one of the areas that the visuals suffer. It doesn't particularly improve throughout the later episodes. The maps that play well generally had better visuals, so I guess there's that. But you have a lot of stuff like rooms made out of organic material that were shaped exactly the same as rooms made out of like metal or Startan or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I personally have a problem with that. And there were some nice areas. Like, I've always said that Peacorp can do caves pretty well. That's probably why I like stuff like Volcana and whatnot from it. So the cave portion of Caves of Bosnia was pretty good. And stuff like that. When they were, you know, going wacky with the texturing in places, it was generally pretty good. But then you had stuff like the exit door room.
Oh, God. Oh, God. E3M8, for those who are keen, check it out. Or don't check it out if you value your eyesight. You know what? I have to agree. I think it's the visual... And we're going to get to the music shortly, and I'm sure we'll end up seeing something similar there. When you have certain authors who are... certain level designers who are entrenched in their own style, which has its pluses and its negatives, I guess... not that I'm fully qualified to speak on the matter, but from what I've seen, you can see the same sort of approach that goes into the same design philosophy, you might say, that goes into their gameplay as does go into their architecture, visual design, and their music as well. Again, which we'll get to shortly. And I think you're right when you say that the visuals are is heavily entwined with the gameplay in this film. But the one point that I wanted to make is that when I was playing through Whispers of Satan, which is, of course, another peak of Megawad with Chris Sherry, where the distinction between the two authors, incidentally, is a little greater, I find. The approach to visual design is much more obvious there in its uniform approach, by which I mean the theme changes up a heck of a lot more in Whispers of Satan than it does in 2002 A Demonicity. In fact, it's not even that constant in the episodes aren't really delegated to certain themes in 2002 A Demonicy. They sort of are, but they go back to tech at odd places, which I didn't particularly like, as an aside. But with Whispers of Satan, you get hard theme changes. You get from episode 1 to episode 2, you go straight from standard tech-based fare to sort of a Hexen-inspired sort of thing going on, which is very interesting. But the visual approach to sort of shaping rooms and layouts remains almost the same constantly across the entire map set. Even when you get to the hell portions, you're still encountering orthogonal rooms, keys on pillars, that sort of shindig. And it just heavily, it highlights once again the uniform approach that Peikoff has to design, and I think he really needs to spice it up a bit more, or go outside his comfort zone in that regard, which is true also for his gameplay, but visuals, I think, would be an easier thing to switch up. And it's true to say that he does do capes very well. Volcana is a high on my list for maps I like enjoy to play.
So, overall, how would you say the visuals hold up?
Oh, goodness. Oh, let's see. Visuals, an A major with added ninth, and B flat. Don't play it. Sounds horrible. Now, so, here's a small little aside, because we have two little categories to get through. Probably not enough to speak about as gameplay, since that's the heaviest, the meatiest category. But innovation. I think something I was just touching upon there, and I think particularly with Peikoff's design, the category could be expanded a little bit when we're talking about uniqueness and originality. Is there anything particularly unique, do you think, about 2002 Demodicy? Anything particular to that map set that you wouldn't find in any other peak or venture, for example? Because I find personally that it's very difficult to recommend 2002 over anything else that Peikoff has done, which I would consider to be highly regarded. I think I said at the end of the stream through, in fact, just go play Simply Phobos instead. Because, as is the case with some authors who are ingrained in their own style, I think it's better to stick to a smaller number of maps to get a sort of bite-sized encounter. I mean, you might be able to go through three or four maps maybe before you sort of have to put the map set down because you can't take any more of that design. But, you know, Simply Phobos is nine maps in length, and I feel that length complements Peikoff's design very well. I think when you stretch it out to something like 38, then it's an absolute slog, as we touched upon in gameplay. So I can't recommend it on any grounds, and I can't call it original either. Except maybe that it's uniquely bad.
No, see, I wouldn't entirely agree with that, because we're focusing too much on Peikoff, because he does dominate the beginning half of it. But when you get to, like, E4, which was the highlight of it, it's not Peikoff anymore, it's Chris Hansen. In fact, that's just basically the Chris Hansen episode with, you know, yeah, there's two Peikoff maps, but, you know, whatever. I don't know if I'd really call it original, because there's very little things in Doom I'd really classify as original. But I would say that, in terms of if you're playing this as a Peikoff map set, yeah, anything that Peikoff has done is pretty much better than this, with the exception of a couple of really bad things he's made. But if you're playing it for, you know, the non-Peikoff stuff, I'd say that, like Chris Hansen's maps, you know, whether you like them or not, are at least, you know, diverse and different enough that I could recommend them just to check them out. And, sure. Of course, E4M6. So, yeah, I couldn't recommend it on the whole, though.
Okay. something that we haven't really touched upon is the fact, and maybe we could talk about the decision behind Peacock electing to, rather than do a sequel or something, simply re-release Mapset as a 10th anniversary edition, which I imagine some demo recorders might have been a little bit pissed about, considering, you know, there was 10 years they might have had a particular demo down, which would have then desynced because, you know, either replaced an app entirely or edited it somewhat. Do you see much point in what he's done there? Or I suppose if there is a point, do you think is he done enough for the 10th anniversary edition? I know certainly that he said he would have corrected some spelling and grammar issues,
I personally believe that the text file was much better when every single your was UR, but
oh, yes.
No, that could just be me.
That
no,
was highly innovative.
I think if you look at E3 M5 and E4 M1, both of which are you know, not particularly exciting additions, you would think that 10 years later, you know, Peak Orf would come back and he'd put in some, you know, I guess I could say E3 M5 is probably better than most of the other Peak Orf maps, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like as evolved and polished as, you know, some of his more modern efforts, where his style, you know, he is very entrenched in his style and probably never going to change. But he still can, you know, do some decent to good things with that. And I don't think that – I would say that adding the new maps, they were consistent with the rest of it, if we could consider that a positive. But I don't think it added enough for a re-release.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's all that can be said on that front, honestly. So innovation, C sharp, with no fifth, suspended fourth, and D. Geez, that's ugly. Don't play that on your harpsichord. And finally, incidentally, music, which I think doesn't get discussed enough as being as complementing the experience of playing through a map set. Usually, it gets discussed independently, saying this track is good, that track is good, as an aside. But yeah, what do you think about the music there, Townsman?
I think if there's one area I can recommend downloading, even though I believe there is a separately released music pack, 2002 and Doom Odyssey 4, it would be the music. I definitely think Peak Orf is a stronger musician than he is a level designer, and there are a lot of tracks he's made that I really like. But with that said, Peak Orf's level design and gameplay and visuals perfectly reflects his music. Primarily, his music's very repetitive. It's very it sounds symmetrical, if that's even it just like you can pick out a Peak Orf track. And he also tends to, for every good track he makes
one
track
with Polka in it.
Fuck you, that track's awesome. He makes a track with nothing but steel drums and bagpipes in it, and then he uses drums as a primary instrument, and I don't think that turns out well. In fact, I want to make this very broad generalization with Peak Orf music. The less guitar used in a Peak Orf song, the better it is. Peak Orf does one type of music really well. The atmospheric building track. All of his really good tracks build from a slow start into something else. And even if I don't like the start or, like, you know, the underlying bass, what they build into is generally good. Like E3MA, which is a great track, I'm not particularly a big fan of the start, which, you know, the starting instrumentation carries out throughout the entire song, and it's always there in the background, but it's, you know, what it builds into, the main, you know, what's in the foreground of the song that I really like. And all of his tracks that I find particularly enjoyable all share that, you know, that build from a kind of atmospheric start. But when you listen to the atmospheric start, like in E2M7, I believe is where it is, which the song is closely based off the start of another Doom song, except Peak Orf's version of it, the intro goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on, and then it finally starts building. And that kind of just, you know, taking one thing and then just, you know, doing it, repeating it, and then, you know, changing and then not really changing really complements his level design, I think. So that's just the technical aspects of Peak Orf music.
Sure. You know, it strikes me as sort of odd, honestly, because when you play certain levels with the accompanying track, you wonder how. I mean, like E2M1. You mean you say the poker track is awesome, but just taking out of the text of some people put down in the forums saying that they've no idea why it was there. It doesn't really complement the sort of killing demons in a Starbase sort of feel to it. It feels incredibly disconnected and bizarre, but then you have maps. I mean, I'm not picking one from 2002 here, but Volcana, for example, which the track just seems perfectly catered towards the map. I don't know. It strikes me as odd that in some certain maps he would elect to sort of make a complete experience like that, and then other maps it almost seems like he had access tracks and he threw them over, no matter how inappropriate they sounded.
When I say the polka music is awesome, I mean for
in itself.
Yes. Well, no, not in itself. In itself, I think it's pretty eh. But it's awesome because it has no fucking place in Doom.
Oh, like, right. Okay.
I want to make a map to fit that music. I don't think it can be done.
Well, poker for a start. Darts everywhere. Pointillism. I don't know.
I agree. Yeah, P Corp seems to wiffle waffle on. I don't know why he does that, but yeah, it is definitely evident in his mapping that sometimes he makes the track actually fit what's going on, and sometimes he doesn't. I think that's why I like his atmospheric tracks more, because they generally do fit the map.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I think P-Corf kind of just works on the, I'm going to make as much stuff as possible, and eventually something will work, just, you know, because I've made so much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for his music, at least, that approach is taken, and just, if it fits, it fits. If it doesn't, well, this is a serious hell map, bagpipes and steel drums.
He is quite adverse to the steel drums in Hell Maps, I have noticed. At least from my playthroughs of Whispers of Satan, that's something I took note of. So music, I'm going to give it incidentally, since we're on the topic of music, GMH a 13th. With no 5th. Try that out, see how that sounds. I think it perfectly captures the positives and the negatives. You can hear a hint of both in that chord, I think. But also the inconsistency, I think, has captured that as well. I've put a lot of effort into this. I'm not just spitting these out of my arse. Okay. Now, just in conclusion, I think, as an overall, before we get to the actual chord-based composition that so perfectly encapsulates this review. Thanks, Jimmy. Ahead. Are there any standout maps? And could you perhaps round up this review in words?
I've already said the standout maps, Chris Hansen's, mm-hmm. Joe Pelai's.
As a reminder, I suppose.
E2M7, because it was such a departure from mm-hmm. the blandness of the rest of the P-Corfian design up to that point.
The Corfian, I like it.
P-Corfian, yes. Those were really the standout moments. I did enjoy episode 4, and besides that, 2002 and Doom Odyssey is 38 maps. Not a lot of them are very good. And is it a product of its time? Probably not. I think that, you know, you can go back and find lots of stuff made 10 years ago.
I don't think it is a product of its time. I think P-Corf is timeless.
I think P-Corf is timeless. I think that 2002 and Doom Odyssey is the worst example of P-Corf's standard, never-changing design.
Have you played the Twilight series?
No.
Megawatts by him previously. I mean, that's up to you if you want to dig into it.
Oh.
Is this far back in time as you're willing to go?
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm sorry. Did you have a revelation?
Just that those exist, but I think that with 38 maps and all of the really changing stuff backloaded in the set, that 2002 at Doom Odyssey really could have used
some trimming.
Kill Your Darlings. It didn't need that many maps. Too many of them, even though they probably weren't when they were made, felt like filler. Like, E1, in fact, you could just get rid of E1. I'm just going to say that. E1,
no tech bases.
I don't even... No tech bases.
Tech bases, Thompson.
I think E1 taints the whole experience, because it does get better and better and better from E1, consistently. But E1 sets up all of the problems. It lets you know right off the bat, this is what you're going to get, this is going to be the problems, this is never going to change, and then it just takes that, it applies it and applies it and applies it. And so, you know, the episodes do get better, but why do they get better? Because they lose the E1 authors. The less that Christian Aro and Peacorf contribute to the maps, the better they get, simply because things change.
Yes, even if they are for the worse in some cases, as some people argue, like with E3M6.
Yes, things change, and that's really what I think the biggest problem with 2002 Doom Odyssey is that it just... It gets to the point where you get lost in simple layouts, because the layouts are so basic that it's like you have no interest in completing the map.
Yes, that's something I failed to mention when we were discussing the gameplay aspect of things. It was the fact that because I was so disengaged and wasn't interested in the maps, I was constantly getting lost, and it was just drawing out the process a lot more. I would pick up keys and not even realize I'd pick them up. I'd walk through key doors and not realize I'd actually already completed that objective. I was that disengaged. And I suppose that's one thing from your particular summary there that I would like to highlight again. However, I would like to say, this is not a positive note to learn, but it is a useful one, I think. I would recommend checking out the map set, if only to see what Peacock's style is, and sort of maybe if you've listened to this podcast and you're interested in... and seeing what the heck we're talking about, maybe looking at things you'd like to adapt into your style or avoid, preferably, hopefully avoid, then it will be an interesting expedition, indeed, on that point. So I think that just about wraps it up for this first episode of Where's All the Data? 2002 Doom Odyssey 10th Anniversary Edition. And we'll give Jimmy a bonus chord here, an F major. He can do whatever he likes with. It's over to you, Jimmy.